The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is John Carlson from North Carolina Reading Service. I will be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Buse. Chapter 31, Italy, Sinbad the Sailor. Near the beginning of the year 1838, two young men belonging to fashionable Parisian society, Viscount Albert de Morcerf and Baron Franz d'Epiphany, found themselves in Florence. They had agreed that they would meet to spend that year's carnival together in Rome, where Franz, who had lived in Italy for nearly 4 years, would serve as Albert's guide. Since visiting Rome for the carnival is no small matter, especially when one does not intend to spend the night in the Piazza del Popolo or the Campo Vaccino, they wrote to Signor Pastorini, proprietor of the Hotel de Londres in the Piazza di Spagna, to request him to reserve a comfortable suite for them. Pastorini replied that he could only offer them two rooms and a drawing room al secondo piano, for which he would accept the modest emolument of a louis a day. The two young men accepted, and then, wishing to make use of the intervening period, Albert left for Naples, while Franz remained in Florence. When he had spent some time enjoying life in the city of the Medici, where he had walked back and forth in that Eden which is known as the Cassini, when he had been a guest in the houses of those splendid hosts who do the honors of Florence, he took a fancy, having already seen Corsica, the cradle of Bonaparte, to visit the island of Elba, that great staging post in the life of Napoleon. So one evening, he untied a barracha from the iron ring that was attached in it to the docks of Leghorn, settled himself in the stern, wrapped in a cloak, and spoke only those words to the sailors, "To Elba." The boat left the harbor like a seabird leaving its nest, and the next day put Franz down in Porto Ferraro. He crossed the imperial island, following every trace that the giant's footsteps had left there, and embarked at Marciana. 2 hours after leaving land, he touched it again, getting off at Pianosa, where he had been assured that he would find infinite numbers of red partridge. The hunting proved poor. Franz killed barely a handful of thin birds, and like any huntsman who had tired himself out to no purpose, got back into his boat in a rather bad humor. "Now, if your excellency wishes," said the boatman, "you could have some good hunting." "Where?" "Do you see that island?" the boatman said, pointing southwards and indicating a conical mass which rose out of the sea, bathed in the loveliest indigo light. "What is it?" Franz asked him. "Monte Cristo," said the laborerman. "But I have no license to hunt on that island." "Your excellency does not need permission. The island is deserted." "Well, I never," said the young man. "That's rare, a desert island in the middle of the Mediterranean." "But natural, excellency, the island is a mass of rock. There is perhaps not so much as an acre of cultivable land on all its surface. And to whom does it belong?" "To Tuscany." "What game will I find there?" "Thousands of wild goats." "Which live by licking the rocks, I suppose," Franz said with an incredulous smile. "No, by gazing on the heather, the myrtles, and the gum trees that grow between them." "Where could I sleep?" "On the ground, in the caves, or on board in your cloak. In any case, if your excellency wishes, we can leave immediately. The hunt is over. As your excellency knows, we can sail as well by night as by day, and if the wind fails, we can row." As Franz still had some time before he needed to meet his friend, and as he was assured of the lodgings in Rome, he accepted this proposal to compensate for the disappointment of his previous hunt. On his ascent, the sailors exchanged a few words in a whisper. "Well," he asked, "what now? Is there some problem?" "No," said the master of the boat, "but we must advise your excellency that the island has been designated contumace." "What does that mean?" "It means that, since Monte Carlo is uninhabited, and is sometimes used as a staging post by smugglers and pirates from Corsica, Sardinia, or Africa, If there is any evidence of our having stopped there, we shall be obliged, when we return to Leghorn, to spend 6 days in quarantine. The devil we will. That puts a different complexion on this. 6 days. The same time that it took God to create the world, it's a bit too long, my friends. But who is to say that His Excellency has been to Monte Cristo? I certainly shan't, France exclaimed. And neither will we, said the sailors. In that case, ahoy from Monte Cristo. The master ordered them to change course for the island, and the boat began to sail in that direction. France waited for the maneuver to be completed, and when the new course was set, the wind was filling the sail, and the four sailors had resumed their places, three at the bow, one at the rudder. He resumed his conversation with the captain. "My dear Titano," he said, "I think you just said that the island of Monte Cristo was a refuge for pirates. This is rather a different game from goats." Yes, Excellency, that's a fact. I knew that where there were such people as smugglers, but I thought that since the capture of Algiers and the destruction of the Regency, that there were no pirates left outside the novels of Fenimore Cooper and Captain Marryat. Your Excellency is wrong. The same is true of pirates as of bandits, who were supposed to have been exterminated by Pope Leo VII, but who nonetheless stopped travelers every day right up to the gates of Rome. Did you not hear that barely 6 months ago the French charge d'affaires to the Holy See was robbed 500 yards from Velletri? Yes, I did. Now, if Your Excellency were to live in Leghorn, as we do, you would hear from time to time that a vessel laden with merchandise or a pretty English yacht which was expected in Basita, Porto Viara, or Civita Vecchia has not made port, and that no one knows what has become of it, except that it has doubtless been wrecked on some rock. Well, the rock that it hit was a low, narrow boat with 6 or 7, 8 men on board, which surprised it and pillaged it some dark and stormy night off a wild, uninhabited island, just as bandits stop and pillage a mail coach at the entrance to a wood. But in that case, said Franz, still lying back in his boat, why don't the victims of the actions complain and bring down the vengeance of the French, Tuscan, or Sardinian governments on the head of the pirates? Why not? Chitano asked with a smile. Yes, why not? Because, first of all, they unload everything that is worth taking off the ship or the yacht, and they put it in their boat. Then they tie the hands and feet of the crew, tie a cannonball around the neck of each man, make a hole as big as a barrel in the keel of the captured vessel, go back up the deck, batten down the hatches, and return to their boat. 10 minutes later, the ship starts to moan and groan, then bit by bit, it founders. From one side, then the other goes under, then it rises up, then it dips down again, slipping lower and lower each time. Suddenly, there is a noise like a cannon shot. That's the air bursting the deck. Then the vessel struggles like a drowning man, getting heavier with every movement that it makes. Soon the water, trapped under pressure from inside, bursts out of every opening like a spouting liquid from the air holes of a gigantic whale. Finally, it gives its death cry, rolls over on itself, and goes under, leaving a huge funnel in the deep, which spins for an instant, then gradually fills, and eventually disappears altogether. The result is that in 5 minutes, only the eye of God Himself can see a trace of the vanished ship beneath the calm of the surface of the sea. Now do you understand, he added, smiling again, why the ship does not return to port and the crew does not lodge a complaint? If Gaetano had told him the story before suggesting their expedition, Franz would quite probably have thought twice before agreeing to it. But they were on their way, and he felt it would be cowardly to go back. He was one of those who do not court danger, but who, if it presents itself, retain all their composure in confronting it. He was one of those calm-willed men who considered a risk in life as they do an opponent in a duel, measuring his movements, studying his strength, and breaking off long enough to catch their breath, but not enough to appear cowardly. Such men, assessing all their adventures with a single glance, kill with a single blow. Huh, he continued, I have crossed Sicily and Calabria. I've sailed around the archipelago for 2 months, and never yet have I seen a trace of any bandit or pirate. But I did not say that to Your Excellency in order to suggest that you should alter your plans. Your Excellency asked me a question, and I replied, nothing more. Yes, my dear Gaetano, and your conversation is most interesting. So, as I want to enjoy it as long as possible, let's go to Monte Cristo. However, they were quickly nearing the end of their journey, had a fresh wind in their sails, and the boat was making 6 or 7 knots. At their approach, the island seemed to rise out of the sea. Through the clear atmosphere of the dying rays of the sun, they could see, like cannonballs in an arsenal, the massive rocks piled up, one above the other, with between them the dark red of the heather and the light green of the trees. Though the sailors appeared perfectly calm, it was clear that they were watchful, scanning the vast mirror across which the boat was slipping, its horizon interrupted only by the white sails of a few fishing boats, which hovered like seagulls on the crest of the waves. They were scarcely more than 15 miles from Monte Cristo when the sun began to set behind Corsica, the mountains of which rose up to their right darkly serrated against the sky. The massive stones rose threateningly in front of the boat like a giant adamastor, its crest gilded by the sun, which was concealed behind it. Little by little, the shadowy figure came up and out of the sea and appeared to drive before it the last ray of the dying day, until at last the shaft of light was driven to the very tip of the cone, where it paused for a moment like a flaming plume of a volcano. Finally, the darkness, still rising, progressively swept across the summit, as it had previously swept across the base, and the island had only the appearance of a mountain, growing constantly a darker shade of gray. Half an hour later, everything was pitch black. Luckily, the sailors were in familiar waters and knew every rock in the Tuscan archipelago. Otherwise, in the midst of this blackness that had enfolded the boat, Franz might not have been altogether easy in his mind. Corsica had vanished entirely, and even the island of Monte Cristo had become invisible, but the sailors seemed to have the lynx's faculty of seeing in the dark, and the pilot, sitting in the rudder, did not show the slightest hesitation. About an hour had passed since the sunset when Franz thought he could see a dark shape about a quarter mile to the left. It was so difficult to distinguish that it could be that rather than risking the sailor's mockery by mistaking some passing clouds or land, he said nothing. But suddenly a great light appeared on the shore. The land might resemble a cloud, but this fire was not a meteor. "What's that light?" he asked. "Hush," said the boatman. "It's a fire." "But you said the island was uninhabited." "I said that it had no permanent inhabitants, but I also mentioned that smugglers sometimes put in there." "And pirates?" "And pirates," said Gaetano, repeating Francis' words. "That's why I gave the order to sail past the island. As you can see, the fire is behind us." "But surely," Franz said, "it seems to me that this fire should reassure us rather than otherwise. People who are afraid of being seen would not have lit a fire like that." "Oh, that means nothing," said Gaetano. "If you could judge the position of the island in the darkness, you would see that the fire is sited in such a way that it cannot be seen from the coast or from the Piosa, but only from the open sea. So you suspect that this fire indicates unwelcome company." "That's what we must find out," said Gaetano, keeping his eyes fixed on the terrestrial star. "How can we do that?" "You'll see." At this, Gaetano had a few words with his comrades, and after they talked for 5 minutes, they carried out a maneuver which allowed them instantly to reverse course. In this way, they were sailing back in the direction from which they had come. And a few minutes later, the fire disappeared, hidden behind some outcrop on the land. At this, the pilot altered course, yet again with the rudder, and the little boat came visibly closer to the island until it was only some 50 yards offshore. Gaetano lowered the sail, and the boat remained stationary. All this had taken place in the most profound silence. Indeed, since the change of course, not a word had been spoken on board. Gaetano, having suggested the expedition, had taken full responsibility for it on himself. The four sailors kept peering at him, preparing the oars, and evidently getting ready to row to shore, which, thanks to the darkness, was not difficult. As for Franz, he was inspecting his weapons with the characteristic sang-froid we have mentioned. He had 2 double-barreled guns and a rifle, which he loaded. He cocked them and waited. Meanwhile, the master had taken off his shirt and jacket and secured his trousers around his waist. As he was barefoot, he had no shoes or stockings to remove. Once dressed, or rather undressed like this, he put his fingers to his lips to show that they should observe complete silence, and after slipping gently into the sea, swam towards the shore. but so cautiously that they could not hear the slightest sound. His path could be followed only by the phosphorescent trail he left in his wake. Soon after this disappeared, and it was clear that Gaetano had reached land. For half an hour, everyone on the boat remained motionless. Then the same luminous furrow reappeared near the shore and came towards them. In a moment and two strokes, Gaetano was alongside. "Well," Franz and the other four sailors asked simultaneously. "Well," said Gaetano, "they are Spanish smugglers, and they only have two Corsican bandits." "What are two Corsican bandits doing with Spanish smugglers?" "Bless my soul," said Gaetano, in tones of the most sincere Christian charity. "We are here to help one another, Excellency. Bandits are often hard-pressed on land by the Gendarmes or the Carabinieri, so they find a boat with good fellows like us in it. They come and request the hospitality of our floating house. How can one refuse to succor a poor devil with men on his tail? We take him in and, for greater safety, put out to sea. This costs us nothing, and it saves the life, or at least the freedom, of one of our fellow men who, as it happens, acknowledges the service we have done for him by showing us a good spot to put off our cargo where it was safe from prying eyes." "Oh, I see," said Franz. "And are you a bit of a smuggler yourself, then, my dear Gaetano?" "What do you expect, Excellency?" he replied with an indescribable smile. "One does a bit of everything. A man must live." "So you know where you stand with the present inhabitants of Monte Cristo?" "More or less. We sailors are like Freemasons. We recognize one another by certain signs. And you think we shall have nothing to fear if we disembark here in our turn?" "Nothing at all. Smugglers are not thieves." "But what about two Corsican bandits?" Franz insisted, trying to allow for every possibility. "Good Lord," said Gaetano. "It's not their fault if they're bandits. It's their fault. It's the fault of the authorities." "How can that be?" "Of course, they are being hunted down because they made their bones, nothing more, as if revenge wasn't in a Corsican's nature." "What do you mean by making their bones? Having killed someone?" Franz asked, still curious. "I mean killing an enemy," said the master. "That's quite different." "Well then," the young man said, "let's go and ask for the hospitality and of these smugglers and bandits. Will they welcome us?" "No doubt at all." "How many of them are there?" "Four, Excellency. With two bandits, that makes six." "Just the same as us, in fact, and if the gentlemen should prove unfriendly, then we are in a position to keep them at bay. So, one last time, let's land on Monte Cristo." "Yes, Excellency, but will you allow me to take a few extra precautions?" "What, my good fellow? Be as wise as Nestor and as cautious as Ulysses. I will not only allow it, I beg you." "Silence," said Gaetano, and they all fell silent. For someone like Franz, who considers everything in its turn, light, the situation, while not dangerous, still gave pause for serious thought. He was here in the most profound darkness, in the middle of the sea, with sailors who did not know him and who had no reason to be loyal to him, who, moreover, knew that he had a few thousand francs in his belt and who had 10 times examined his guns, at least with curiosity, if not envy. They were fine pieces. In addition to that, escorted by only these men, he was about to land on an island which certainly had a very religious name, but which appeared to offer Franz no greater hospitality than Calvary did to Christ, in view of the smugglers and the bandits. Then those stories of scuttled ships, which he had thought exaggerated by daylight, seemed more believable in the dark. So caught between this, perhaps imaginary, double danger, he did not take his eyes off the man or his hand off the rifle. During this time, the sailors had once more raised their sails and resumed their previous course. Through the darkness, Franz, whose eyes were already becoming somewhat accustomed to it, could see the granite giant beside which the boat was sailing. Then finally, as they came around a rock for the second time, he saw the fire burning more brightly than ever, and around it 5 or 6 seated figures. The light extended some 100 yards across the sea. Gaetano sailed just outside its reach, keeping the boat in the unlit darkness beyond. Then, when he was directly across from the bonfire, he turned the bow towards it and sailed boldly into the circle of light, singing a fisherman's song and taking the main part himself, while the crew joined in with the chorus. At the first words of the song, the men sitting around the fire got up and walked across the landing stage, keeping close watch on the approaching boat so as to assess its size and intentions. They soon appeared to have satisfied themselves and went back to their places around the fire, where a kid was roasting, apart from one who remained standing on the shore. When the boat was about 20 yards from land, the man on the shore mechanically gestured with his carbine like a sentry greeting a returning patrol and shouted, "Who goes there?" in Sardinian patois. Franz cocked his repeating rifle unemotionally. At this, Gaetano exchanged a few words with the man, which Franz could not understand, though they clearly concerned him. "Does your excellency wish to be named?" the master asked, "or would he prefer to go incognito?" "My name must be entirely unknown to these men," Franz said, "so just tell them that I'm a Frenchman who is traveling for his own amusement." When Gaetano had communicated this to him, the sentry gave an order to one of the men sitting in the fire. He immediately got up and disappeared among the rocks. There was a silence. Everyone appeared preoccupied with his own affairs, Franz with the landings, the sailors with their sails, the smugglers with their kid, but in the midst of this apparent lack of curiosity, they were observing one another. The man who had gone away suddenly came back from the opposite direction to the one in which he had gone. He nodded to the sentry, who turned to them and merely said, "Si accomodi." This Italian, "si accomodi," is untranslatable. It means at once, "Come, come in, welcome, make yourself at home, you are the master." It is like the Turkish phrase in Molière's play, which astonished the bourgeois gentilhommes by the meaning that it could contain. The sailors did not want to be asked twice. With four strokes of the oars, they brought their boat ashore. Gaetano jumped on the beach, whispered a few more words to the sentry, and his crew then came down, one after the other. Finally, it was Franz's turn. He had one of his guns slung across his shoulder. Gaetano had the other, and one of the sailors was holding his rifle. His dress had something of both the artist and the dandy, which aroused no suspicion in the host, and consequently no unease. The boat was tied up to the shore, and they started to walk around, looking for a suitable place to camp. But the direction in which they were walking was not to the liking of the smuggler who was acting sentry, because he shouted to Gaetano, "No, not over there, please." Gaetano mumbled some excuse, and without argument, went over to the other side, where, while two sailors went to fetch lighted torches so that they could see their way. They went about for 30 yards, then stopped on a little esplanade entirely surrounded by rocks, in each of which a kind of seat had been hollowed, not unlike a small sentry boxes where the guard can sit down. Around them, in patches of soil, grew some dwarf oaks and thick clumps of myrtle. Franz lowered a torch and recognized from a pile of ashes that he was not the first person to notice the comfort of this spot, which must be one of the usual stopping places of random visitors to Monte Cristo. He stopped worrying about any incident that might occur. Once on dry land and having seen the mood of his hosts, which if not friendly was at least one of indifference, all his anxieties had vanished. With the smell of roast kid coming from the nearby camp, anxiety had changed to appetite. He mentioned this to Gaetano, who said that nothing was easier than to make supper when they had bread, wine, and six partridge in the boat, and a fire to prepare them. Moreover, he added, "If your excellency is so tempted by the smell of that kid, I can go and offer your neighbors two of our birds for a slice of their beast." "Do it, Gaetano, do it," said Franz. "You are the born negotiator." Meanwhile, the sailors had pulled up handfuls of heather and made firewood from the myrtle and green oak branches, then set fire to it, so that they had quite a blaze going. Franz was waiting impatiently, sniffing the smell of roasting kid, when the master came back and with an anxious look. "What now?" asked Franz. "Had they refused our offer?" "On the contrary," Gaetano replied, "their chief, on learning that you are a young Frenchman, has invited you to dine with him." "Well, well," said Franz, "this chief is a most civil man, and I see no reason to refuse, all the more so I'm bringing my own contribution to the meal." "It's not that. There is more than enough to eat, but he is imposing an unusual condition on your visiting his home." "His home? Does he have a house here, then?" "No, but I am assured that he has a very comfortable home, nonetheless." "Do you know this chief?" "I have heard speak of him. Good things or bad? Both." Well, damn it, what is this condition? That you should let your eyes be bandaged and not remove the blindfold until you are told you can do so. Franz read what he could into Gaetano's face to discover what was behind the suggestions. Gaetano read his thoughts. The devil, he said. I know, it needs thinking about. What would you do in my place? The young man asked. I've got nothing to lose. I'd go. You would agree? Yes, if only out of courtesy or curiosity. So this chief can show us something unusual? Listen, Gaetano said, lowering his voice. I don't know if what they say is true. He paused and looked around to make sure they were not overheard. What do they say? They say that the chief lives in a subterranean abode, besides which is the Pitti Palace, is a mere trifle. What a dream, Franz said, sitting down again. Oh, it's not a dream. It's a reality. Kama, a pilot of the Saint Fernand, went in there one day and came out completely dazzled, saying that such treasures as only exist in fairy stories. You know, said Franz, what you're telling me sounds as if you were trying to lure me into the caves of Ali Baba. I'm only saying what I was told, Excellency. So you advise me to accept? That I'm not saying. Your Excellency will do as well as he pleases. I should not like to advise him in such circumstances. Franz thought for a few moments, realized that such a rich man could not feel any envy for him, as he had only a few thousand francs with him, and, since he could see nothing coming out of this but an excellent dinner, accepted. Gaetano went back with his aunt. However, as we mentioned, Franz was prudent, so he wanted to know as much as he could about the strange and mysterious host. Consequently, he went back to the sailor, who, while the above conversation was going on, had been plucking the partridges with the grave air of a man proud of his job, and asked him what kind of vessel the other men had landed in, since he could not see any Sepinara, tartan, or other boat. I'm not concerned about that, the sailor said. I know their vessel. Is it a fine one? I wish your excellency such a one. Should he sail round the world? What is its displacement? 100 tons or thereabouts. In any event, it is a pleasure boat, a yacht, as the English call it, but built, you understand, in such a way that it can go to sea in any weather. Where was it built? That I don't know, but I believe in Genoa. And how does the head of a gang of smugglers, Franz asked, dare to have a yacht built for his trade in the port of Genoa? I didn't say the owner of the yacht was a smuggler, the sailor replied. No, but I believe Gaetano said so. Gaetano had seen the crew from a distance, but he had not yet spoken to anyone. And if the man is not a smuggler, then what is he? A rich aristocrat who travels for his own pleasure. Come now, Franz thought to himself, this man is becoming more and more mysterious, since the stories differ. Then he said aloud, what is his name? When asked, he replies that he is called Sinbad the Sailor, but I suspect this may not be his true name. Sinbad the Sailor? Yes. Where does the gentleman live? At sea. What country does he come from? I don't know. Have you seen him? A few times. What is he like? Your Excellency can judge for himself. And where will he entertain me? Doubtless in the underground palace that Gaetano mentioned. But you have never been curious when you landed on this island and found it deserted to try and enter the enchanted palace? Oh, yes, indeed, Excellency, the sailor replied. More than once, in fact, but all our efforts have been fruitless. We have looked all round the grotto and not found the smallest passageway. In any case, it is said that the door does not open with a key, but with a magic word. I have definitely stepped off into a tale from the 1001 Nights, Franz muttered. His Excellency awaits you, said a voice behind him, which he recognized as that of the sentry. He had with him 2 men from the crew of the yacht. In reply, Franz took out his handkerchief and offered it to the man who had spoken. Without a word, they blindfolded him, taking enough care to show that they were afraid he might commit some indiscretion, then made him swear that he would not try to remove the blindfold. He swore. At that, the 2 men each took one of his arms, and they led him forward, preceded by the sentry. After some 30 paces, he guessed from the increasingly appetizing smell of kid that they were walking past the encampment. They carried on for about 50 paces more, clearly proceeding in the direction that had been forbidden to Gaetano, which explained why they had not wanted him to go there. Soon, from the change in the air, he realized that he was going underground, and after they had walked for a few more seconds, he heard a creaking sound and felt that the air had again changed to become warm and scented. Finally, he felt his feet walking on thick, soft carpet, and his guides let go of his arms. There was a moment's silence, and a voice said, in good French, though with a foreign accent, "Welcome to my home, monsieur. You may take off your handkerchief." As one may imagine, Franz did not wait to be asked again. He took off his handkerchief and found himself standing in front of a man of between 38 and 40, wearing Tunisian dress, that is to say, a red skull cap with a long blue silk tassel, a jacket and black woolen cloth embroidered all over with gold thread, wide, loose, dark trousers with gaiters in the same color, embroidered in gold like the jacket, and yellow Turkish slippers. Around his waist was a splendid cashmere belt with a sharp little curved dagger hanging from it. Although his coloring was almost livid white, the man had a remarkably handsome face. The eyes were bright and penetrating, the nose straight and almost on a level with the forehead, suggesting the purest Greek type, and the teeth, white as pearls, shone splendidly under the dark mustache. It was only the pallor that was strange. The man looked as if he had been shut up for a long time in a tomb, and afterwards had been unable to recover the natural rosy complexion of the living. Though not very tall, he was well built and had the small hands and feet typical of Mediterranean men. However, what astonished Franz, who had treated Gaetano's story as a fantasy, was the sumptuousness of the furnishings. The whole room was hung with crimson Turkish hangings, brocaded with gold flowers. In a recess, there was a sort of divan. Above it, a display of Arab swords with vermeil sheaths and hilts shining with precious stones. From the ceiling dangled a lamp in Venetian glass, delightful in shape and color, and his feet sank up to the ankles in the Turkish rug underneath them. There were curtains hanging in front of the door by which Franz had entered, and in front of another door which led into a second room which seemed to be splendidly lit. The man allowed his guest a moment to take all this in, while using the opportunity to examine him in turn and keeping his eyes fixed on him. "Monsieur," he said finally, "I beg you to forgive me 1,000 times for the precautions that we had to take before showing you my home. But since this island is deserted for most of the time, if the secret of where I live to get out should get out, it would no doubt return to find my dwellings in a rather poor state. I should be much displeased at this, not because any loss that it might occasion, but because I should no longer have the assurance that whenever I wish, I can separate myself from the rest of the world. Now I shall try to make you forget any slight displeasure I may have caused you by offering you something that you surely did not expect to find here, namely a decent supper and quite a good bed." "My dear host," said Franz, "you must not apologize. I know that people who visit enchanted palaces always do so blindfold. Look at Raoul and the Huguenots, and I really have no cause for complaint, because what you are showing me is equal to the marvels of the Arabian Nights. Alas, I have to say, like Lucullus, if I had known I was going to have the honor of your visit, I should have made some preparation for it. But in the event I put my humble retreat at your disposal and invite you to share my supper, such as it is. Ali, are we served?" At almost that very moment, the curtain in front of the door was raised, and a Nubian, black as ebony and wearing a simple white tunic, indicated to his master that they could proceed to the dining room. "Now," the stranger told Franz, "I am not sure whether you agree with me, but I find nothing more irritating than to spend 2 or 3 hours with a person and not know by what name or title one should address him. Observe that I respect the laws of hospitality too much to ask you your name or title. I should just like to ask you to suggest some name or other which I may use when speaking to you. As for myself, to put it similarly at ease, I should tell you that people are accustomed to calling me Sinbad the Sailor." "And I," said Franz, "I should tell you that, as I have everything except the celebrated magic lamp, I see no objection for the moment to your calling me Aladdin. In this way, we can stay on the Orient, where I suspect that I must have been transported with the help of some good genie." "Well, Aladdin, sir," the strange host said, "you heard that we are served, I think, so please be good enough to come to the dining room. Your humble servant will first go to show you the way." At these words, raising the curtain, Sinbad stepped through the doorway. Franz went from one wonder to another. The table was splendidly laid. Once he had assured himself of this important detail, he looked around. The dining room was no less magnificent than the boudoir that he had just left. It was entirely in marble, with the most precious antique bas-reliefs. The room was oblong, and at each end there were superb statues carrying baskets on their heads. The baskets contained two pyramids of wonderful fruit: silicon pineapples, pomegranates from Malaga, oranges from the Balearics, French peaches, and Tunisian dates. As for the supper, it consisted of a roast peasant sitting on the bed of Corsican blackbirds, a wild boar's ham and jelly, a quarter of a kid of a tartare, a magnificent turbot, and a huge lobster. Between the main dishes were smaller plates with various side dishes. The serving dishes were silver and the plates of Japanese porcelain. Franz rubbed his eyes to make sure he was not dreaming. Only Ali was allowed to wait on them, acquitting himself very well. The guest complimented his host on this fact. "Yes, yes," the other replied, continuing to do the honors of his table in the most easy manner. "He's a poor devil who is most devoted to me and who does his best. He recalls that I saved his life, and as he was attached to his head, apparently, he owes me some gratitude for having preserved it for him." Ali went up to his master, took his hand, and kissed it. "It is very simple," the host said. "It appears that the fellow had wandered closer to the harem of the Bey of Tunis than is acceptable for a lad of his color. In consequence, he was condemned by the Bey to have his tongue, his hand, and his head cut off. The tongue on the first day, the hand on the second, and the head on the third. I'd always wanted to have a dumb servant. I waited for him to have his tongue cut out. Then I went to offer the Bey in exchange for him a splendid two-stroke repeating rifle, which, on the previous day, had appeared to take His Highness's fancy. He hesitated a moment, so keen was he to make an end to this poor devil, but I added to the rifle an English hunting knife, with which I had blunted His Highness's yataghan. As a result, the Bey decided to spare him his hand and his head, on condition that he never again set foot in Tunis. The stipulation was unnecessary. As soon as the miscreant catches sight of the African coach, he flees to the bottom of the hold and cannot be persuaded to come out until we have lost sight of the third quarter of the world." For a moment, Franz said nothing, considering what he's thinking of as this cruel good humor for which the host had told him the story. "And like the honorable sailor whose name you have taken," he asked, changing the subject, "do you spend all of your time traveling?" "Yes, this is the result of a vow I made at a time when I did not expect I should be able to accomplish it," the stranger said with a smile. "I've made a few vows of that sort, and I hope to be able to accomplish all of them in due course." Though Sinbad had spoken these words with the greatest sang-froid, his eyes gave a glance of peculiar ferocity. "Have you suffered a great deal, monsieur?" Franz asked. Sinbad shuddered, stared closely at him. "How can you tell that?" "Everything speaks of it," said Franz. "Your voice, your look, your pallor, even the sort of life that you lead." "What? I led the happiest life of any man I know, the life of a pasha. I am the lord of creation. I am enjoying myself in a place. I stay there. If I'm not bored, I leave. If I am bored, I leave. I'm as free as a bird, and like a bird, I have wings. I've only to make a sign for the people around me to obey me. From time to time, I amuse myself in teasing justice by snatching a wanted bandit away from it, or a criminal with the police on his trail. Then I have my own justice, high and low, which suspends no sentences and hears no appeals, which merely condemns or pardons and concerns nobody. Oh, if you could have tasted my life, you would want no other. You would never return to the world unless you had some great project to carry out." "Some act of vengeance, for example," said Franz. The stranger held the young man in one of those looks that penetrate to the depths of the soul and the mind. "Why revenge?" he asked. "Because," said Franz, "you look to me like a man who has been persecuted by society and has a terrible account to settle with it." "Well, well," Sinbad said, laughing, his strange laugh and showing his sharp white teeth, "you are quite wrong. You might not think it, but I am a kind of philanthropist, and perhaps one day I shall go on to Paris to rival Monsieur Appert and the man in the little blue cloak." "Would that be your first visit?" Certainly it would. I don't appear very curious, do I? I assure you, however, that it is not my fault if I have not been before, and it will happen one day or another. Do you expect to go soon? I don't know yet. It depends on circumstances that are still uncertain. I should like to be there when you come, so that I could return, as far as I'm able, the hospitality that you have been so generous as to offer me on Monte Cristo. I would be most happy to accept your offer, the host replied, but if I do go, unfortunately, it might well be incognito. Meanwhile, the dinner continued, and appeared to have been served purely for Franz, for the stranger had barely nibbled at one or two of the dishes in the splendid feast that he had offered him, and on which his unexpected guest had dined handsomely. Finally, Ali brought the dessert, or rather, he took the baskets from the hands of the statues and placed them on the table. Between the two baskets, he set down a little bowl and for meal, which is the lid of the same metal. Franz's curiosity was awakened by the respect with which the servant had brought this bowl. He lifted the lid and saw a sort of greenish paste that he did not recognize, that resembled a sort of sweet made from an angelica. He replaced the lid, as ignorant of the contents of the bowl, after lifting the lid as he had been before, and turning back to his host, saw him smile at his disappointment. You cannot guess, he said, what kind of foodstuff is in that little container, and it intrigues you, I imagine. I admit it does. I'll tell you, that sort of green sweetmeat is nothing more nor less than the ambrosia that Hebe served at the table of Jupiter. Which ambrosia, said Franz, no doubt on coming into the hand of man, lost its celestial name to take a human one. What is the name of this substance, to which I must admit I feel no great attraction in ordinary speech? Ah, cried Sinbad, it is precisely in this that we reveal our base material origins. Often we pass beside happiness without seeing it, without looking at it, or even we have seen and looked at it without recognizing it. If you are a practical man and gold is your god, then taste this, and the mines of Peru, Garat, and Golconda will be open to you. If you are a man of imagination, a poet, then taste this too, and the boundaries of the possible will vanish. The fields of infinity will be open, and you will walk through them, free in heart, free in mind, in the limitless pastures of Revere. If you are ambitious and seek earthly glory, then you too can taste this, and in an hour you will be a king, not the king of some little kingdom buried away in the corner of Europe, like France, Spain, or England, but king of the world, king of the universe, king of creation. Your throne will be raised up to the mountain where Satan took Jesus, and without having to pay him homage, without having to kiss his claw, you will be the sovereign master of all the kingdoms on earth. Aren't you tempted by my offer? Tell me, is it not an easy thing to do, since there is nothing to do but that? Look. With this, he lifted the lid off the vermeil bowl, which contained the substance of which he had spoken so highly, took a coffee spoonful of the magic sweetmeat, raised it to his lips, and slowly savored it, his eyes half closed and his head leaning back. Franz gave him as long as he needed to enjoy his favorite food. Then, seeing that he had somewhat reverted his attention, said, But tell me, what is this precious sweetmeat? Have you heard speak of the old man of the mountain? His host asked, the one who tried to kill Philip Augustus? Of course. Well, you know that he ruled over a rich valley overlooked by the mountain from which he had taken his picturesque name. In that valley were splendid gardens planted by Hasebin Sabah, and in those gardens were isolated pavilions. According to Marco Polo, he would bring his chosen friends into those pavilions and there make them eat a certain grass which would take them into paradise in the midst of the plants that were always in flower, fruits that were always ripe, and women who were always virgins. What these fortunate young men imagined was reality, was actually a dream, but a dream so sweet, so intoxicating, so voluptuous that they would sell themselves, body and soul, to the person who had procured it for them, obey his orders like those of God, and strike whatever victim he directed at the furthest end of the earth, dying under the torture without a murmur, simply because they believed that the death would suffer was merely a transition to what life of delights of which the holy grass, which you see before you, had given them a foretaste. In that case, Franz exclaimed, it's hashish. Yes, I do know it, at least by name. Precisely. You have said the word, my lord Aladdin. It's hashish, the best and finest hashish of Alexandria. Hashish from Abu Ghor, the great maker, the only man, the man for whom they should build a palace with the following inscription, to the merchant of happiness from a grateful world. Do you know, Franz said, I'm quite eager to judge for myself as to the truth or otherwise of your commendation. Do so, my dear guest, do so. But do not be content with just one experiment. As with everything, the senses must become accustomed to a new impression. Whether it is pleasant or not, happy or sad, nature wrestles with this divine substance because our nature is not made for these joys. It clings to pain. Nature must be defeated in the struggle. Reality must follow dreams, and then the dream will rule, will become the master. The dream will become life, and life become a dream. What a difference is made by this transfiguration when you compare the sorrows of real life to the pleasures of the imaginary one. You will never want to live again, only to dream forever. When you leave your world for that of others, you will feel as if you have traveled from the spring in Naples to winter in Lapland, from paradise to earth, from heaven to hell. Try some hashish, my friend, try it. Instead of replying, Franz took a spoonful of the wonderful paste, about as much as a host had taken, and brought it to his mouth. Damn it, he exclaimed, swallowing the divine substance. I'm not sure if the outcome will be as pleasant as you say, but the thing itself doesn't seem to me as delicious as you claim. That is because the nodes of your palate are not yet accustomed to the sublimity of the thing they are tasting. Tell me, for the first time, did you like oysters, tea, porter, truffles, all these things that you will later adore? Can you understand the Romans who season pheasants with asafoetida and the Chinese who eat birds' nests? Of course you can't. Well, it's the same for hashish. Just try taking it for a whole week, and no food in the world will seem to you comparable in fineness to this taste, which today you find musty and repellent. Now, let us go into the next room, which is your bedroom, and Ali will serve us coffee and grind us some pipes. They both got up, and while the man who called himself Sinbad, the name which we too have been used from time to time so that we may be able to designate him in some way, was giving orders to his servant, Franz went through to the other room. The furnishings were simpler, though no less rich. The room was round, and a large divan extended along the walls. But the divan, the walls, the ceiling, and the floor were hung with splendid animal skins, as sweet and soft as the deepest pile of carpet. There was lion skins across from the Atlas Mountains with great manes. There were tiger skins from Bengal, warmly striped. There were skins of panthers from the Cape, as merrily spotted as the ones that appeared to Dante. Finally, there were bear skins from the Siberia and Norwegian foxes. All these were heaped, one upon the other, in such profusion that one would have imagined oneself to be walking on the thickest lawn and resting on the most silken couch. Both men lay down upon the divan. Chibouks with jasmine stems and amber mouthpieces were within easy reach, all prepared so they could never need to smoke the same one twice. They each took one. Ali lit them and went to fetch coffee. There was a moment's silence in which Sinbad was immersed in the thoughts that seemed continually to occupy him, even in the midst of conversation, and Franz abandoned himself to the silent reverie into which one of the almost invariably falls when smoking fine tobacco, which seems to carry away all the sufferings of the mind on a smoke and give the smoker in exchange all the dreams of the soul. Ali brought them coffee. How would you like it? The stranger said. A la fresca or a la Turk, strong or weak, with sugar, without, fluttered or boiled. You choose. We have it prepared in every manner. I should try Turkish, Franz replied. How right you are, cried his host. This proves that you have a natural disposition for Oriental life. Ah, the Orientals, you understand, are the only people who know how to live. As for me, he added, with one of those odd smiles that did not escape the young man's observant eye, when I have finished my business in Paris, I shall go and die in the East. And then, if you want to find me, you will have to look in Cairo, Baghdad, or Isfahan. I do believe, said Franz, that it will be the easiest thing, because I think I am growing eagle's wings, and with them I shall fly around the world in a day. Ah, that's the hashish working. Well then, open your wings and fly into regions beyond the reach of men. Fear nothing. You are being watched over, and if, like those of Icarus, your wings should melt in the sun, we are here to catch you. He said a few words in Arabic to Ali, who signifies his obedience and retired without going too far away. As for Franz, the strange transformation was taking place in him. All the physical tiredness of the day, all the concerns awakened the mind by the events of the evening were disappearing, as in that first moment of rest when one is still conscious enough to feel the arrival of sleep. His body seemed to acquire the lightness of some immaterial being. His mind became unimaginably clear, and his senses seemed to double their faculties. The horizon was constantly receding. It was no longer that dark horizon which he had seen before falling asleep and over which a vague terror loomed. But for a short while, he enjoyed the cool breeze on his forehead, listened to the muffled sound of waves against the shore. There they left a lace pattern of silvery white foam on the rocks. He abandoned himself, without attempting to analyze it, to the divine charm of natural things, especially when one can enjoy them after a fantastic dream. Then, little by little, his outside life, with its calm, its purity, and its grandeur, recalled the improbability of his dream, and memories began to flood back. He remembered arriving on the island, being introduced to the chief of the smugglers, then an underground palace full of marvels, an excellent dinner, and a spoonful of hashish. But confronted by the reality of the daylight, it seemed to him that all of this had happened at least a year ago. So large did his dream loom in the mind, and immediate did it seem. Thus, from time to time, his imagination took one of the shadowy figures who had lit up in the night with their kisses and made her sit amongst the sailors or walk across a rock or stand on the rocking boat. In any case, his head was quite clear and his body perfectly rested. There was no heaviness in his brain, but on the contrary, a certain general feeling of well-being and ability to absorb the air and sun was greater than ever. So it was with a light heart that he went down to join his sailors. As soon as they saw him, they rose, and the master came across. "Milford Sinbad," he said, "requested us to convey his compliments to your excellency and asked us to express his regret at not being able to bid your majesty farewell. He hopes that you will excuse him when you know that he has urgent business in Malaga." "So, my dear Gaetano," Franz said, "all this is real then. There was a man who welcomed me to this island, treated me royally, and left while I was asleep? So real is he that you can see his little yacht speeding off under full sail. If you want to take your spyglass, you will quite probably recognize your host himself in the midst of his crew." As he said this, Gaetano pointed towards a little boat steering a course off of the southern tip of Corsica. Franz took out his glass, adjusted the focus, and turned it towards the boat indicated. Gaetano was quite right. The mysterious stranger was standing on the stern of his boat, facing in his direction, and like Franz, with a spyglass in his hand. His dress was the same as the one which he had appeared with his guest the previous evening, and he was waving goodbye with his handkerchief. Franz pulled out his own handkerchief and returned the greeting by waving in the same manner. A moment later, a small puff of smoke appeared from the stern of the boat, detached itself from the vessel, and rose in a graceful arc across the sky, after which Franz heard the faint sound of a shot. "There, did you hear that?" said Gaetano. He's bidding you farewell." The young man took his rifle and fired it into the air, but without much expectation that the noise would reach the yacht at the distance from the shore. "What would your excellency like to do?" said Gaetano. "Firstly, go to light me a torch." "Ah, yes, I understand. You want to look for the entrance to the enchanted dwelling. With great pleasure, excellency. If it amuses you, I shall give you the torch you asked for. I, too, had once the same idea as you, and I gave in to it three or four times, but eventually I abandoned the attempt. Giovanni," he added, "light a torch and bring it to his excellency." Giovanni observed, obeyed. Franz took the torch and went into his underground cavern, followed by Gaetano. He recognized the place where he had once woken up by his bed of heather, which was still crumpled. But however much he ran the torch over the walls of the cavern, he could find nothing except traces of smoke, showing where others had been and investigated before him. We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated by Robin Boos. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is John Carlson from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.